we at a similar crossroads where we can either flourish or flounder? Well, the British philosopher A.C. Grayling argues that it's the 17th century that gave birth to the modern mind, to paraphrase the subtitle of his book, The Age of Genius, that this is the significant time in history where the best minds changed from medieval beliefs to a sensibility closer to how we understand the world today. And that all of this happened in a short and likewise tumultuous time. Could there be lessons for us here as we navigate these current testing times of ours? A.C. Grayling is the Master and Professor of Philosophy at the New College of the Humanities in London. He's the author of over 30 books and essays. He's also currently a columnist for Prospect magazine, and I invite you to check out some of his columns there. They're very thought-provoking. So it was a pleasure to welcome Anthony, as he likes to be called, back to Saturday Extra.
Oh, it's lovely to be on it again. Lovely to talk to you, Geraldine.
Thank you. Look, the interview I just mentioned about the Renaissance, this period in the time of the 14th to the 15th centuries, is when these two authors say our thoughts were reshaped around science and education and communications and politics and so on. You suggest that it's actually a later period, the 17th, where history changed so profoundly that everything before it is another world. I wonder what you'd see as the major differences between those two periods, the Renaissance and the 17th century.
Well, I very much agree with Ian Golden and his co-author that the Renaissance period is highly significant because, of course, that's when, so to speak, the water began to boil. But it actually came to the boil in the 17th century. And I think one way of illustrating that fact is to say that for almost all of human history up until the beginning of the 17th century, people thought about the universe and therefore about themselves in one rather distinctive and recognizable way. And from the 17th century onwards, humankind thought about the universe and itself in a very radically different way. And here's the proof. Supposing you took somebody out of doors in the year 1600 to have a look at the night sky on a clear night, what would they see? They would see the great lights of the heavens revolving majestically around the earth at its center, the earth itself being still, motionless. But by the year 1700, people saw the universe very differently. Walk out on a clear night and look up at those stars. What do you see? You see immense distances. You see each of those stars as a sun in its own right, perhaps with a plurality of worlds orbiting them. So this perspective, this change of perspective, places a humankind not at a cosmically significant point at the center of things, but in an entirely different setting, with everything that follows from that about what we understand about human beings, about their destiny, about society, and about the world they occupy. This happened in the 17th century because it was in the 17th century that at last the freedom of thought to encounter and address the challenge of these new ideas happened.
Yes, so it was this fundamental shift in the geography of the human mind, you're saying, that you feel it really did come to its apex at that time.
Yes, that's exactly right. And of course, when you think about matters of perspective, how you see things, where you see them from, has consequences all the way through the rest of the framework of your thinking. This is why the 17th century is so dramatic, an intellectual shift in perspective.
It was also a time of terrible, terrible war. The devastating 30 Years' War, 1618 to 48, which I think all of us say, oh yes, the 30 Years' War, but as it was pointed out to me recently, this was really total war. One in four or one in five Europeans died as a result of the wars and then the rampaging armies sort of destroying their crops and so on. This was really epic. So this all feeds in, does it, to your thesis?
It does indeed, because it's an unfortunate fact about wars, and especially about particularly devastating wars like the ones that the 17th century saw, with these rampaging armies like great swarms of locusts, many, many different armies sweeping backwards and forwards across the landscapes of Europe, sacking cities and burning them to the ground, massacring people, destroying the agriculture. And in a time like that, chaos and anarchy reign. But the little unfortunate fact that there's always a silver lining, even in very dark times like that, is that that meant that people and ideas were able to circulate more freely in Europe. Indeed, there were plenty of people with those armies who traveled, who would never have traveled before, who saw different countries and met different people. The postal services, that was a rather curious little sideline of a discovery about the 17th century, but the fact that people were able to communicate with one another and get these ideas across to one another was a very potentiating factor.
Now, do you mind going on a little bit about that postal service? Because I think a lot of us, you know, sort of 1840, you know, Rowland Hill in England. But of course, it was before that, wasn't it?
Oh, indeed. I mean, for a couple of centuries before that, there had been this family, the Taxis family, who had started a postal service in northern Italy for Venice. And then it had spread and spread and it had become the official postal service of the Holy Roman Empire and for the Spanish Habsburgs. It was very expensive to send a letter in those days. Indeed, the monthly wage of one of the postmen was not sufficient to send one letter. So at the time that the...
So it was for the elites?
Yes, just for the elite, mainly actually for monarchs and governments and so on. But by the time of the 17th century, when people have begun to realize, especially people who were interested in the new science and the new philosophical ideas, that they couldn't keep these things to themselves because they wouldn't get anywhere with them unless they accepted the criticism, the scrutiny, the discussion with other people. And so you got these very significant people, people like Marin Mersenne and Samuel Hartlib and others, who became, if you like, a kind of prototypical internet server, receiving letters from people, making multiple copies, sending them out again to lots of different people, and doing this in a way that really got discussion bubbling up and the idea of a community of thinkers and scholars and savants and scientists took hold in the 17th century, made possible by this distribution of post.
And I suppose what you do make, I think you try to get us to understand, is that it fundamentally blew apart the notion of who had a mortgage on knowledge, and that this was being shared. It wasn't the church, it wasn't the monarchy. But I did wonder that a lot of the people who were the sort of real poster boys for this intellectual progress, a lot of them were deeply exercised by religious questions, and I wonder quite how you took some of that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, religion was the medium in which everybody existed, rather as fish swim in the medium of the sea. And to declare yourself an atheist, some did actually, but they got themselves burned at the stake as a result, was a very outrageous thing to do at the time. A lot of these people, like Isaac Newton, for example, had extremely peculiar religious ideas. They weren't at all orthodox in their view.
Mm. But Descartes, for instance, was God was central to his thinking, wasn't it?
Well, he was certainly very cagey indeed about saying anything of what his actual beliefs were, but he was very orthopractic. That is, he went to Mass every Sunday and he towed the line and wouldn't let on because he was quite a timid individual and he certainly didn't want to get his toes warmed at the stake. So he was very careful, you know, not to let on if he thought anything different from them. But the real religious situation is this. The Protestant Reformation had made whole swathes of Europe, especially Northern Europe and parts of Western Europe, independent of the orthodoxy imposing power of the Roman Catholic Church. Now, the Roman Catholic Church, right up until the 1630s, at the trial of Galileo, tried to stop the new science. If anybody said that they agreed with the Copernican view that the Earth is not at the center of the universe or that the Earth moves, they were quite likely to be killed, I mean, to be burned at the stake. So the church was desperately trying to hold on to that hegemony over thought. Mm. But in the Protestant parts of Europe, the ministers, and we can't call them priests, vicars and ministers and so on, didn't have enough power to do that. That was one thing. But even more importantly, the whole point of Protestantism was to think for yourself in matters of religion. Well, as soon as these savants and philosophers heard that idea, they thought, well, I'm going to think for myself not just in matters of religion, but in all matters.
Yes.
And that's where you get this flourishing of scientific discovery.
Let me just tell listeners, my very welcome guest is Professor A.C. Grayling, whose newest book is The Age of Genius, the 17th Century and the Birth of the Modern Mind. Just before we move on to quite what that might mean for our times, I wonder about the Dutch Golden Age. Like, you've got a lot about England in your book and other parts of Europe, but I just happened recently, I was lucky enough to travel overseas and looked at the amazing artistic achievements of the Dutch Golden Age, where trade, science, military and art were some of the most acclaimed in the world. And do you know what I noticed was the rise in altruism among the elites as well? Very much a sense of reaching the wealthy, assumed they had some responsibility for people who are poorer than themselves and setting up hospices and so on and so forth. And women were put in charge of some of these. Now, would that have all happened if it weren't for the Renaissance period that went before?
I think a key aspect here is the Reformation, which itself, of course, is one of the fruits of the Renaissance, because the Northern Netherlands, the part of the Netherlands which has become what we think of as the Netherlands today, the Southern Netherlands, of course, is now Belgium, became Protestant, and the Southern Netherlands, Belgium, remained Catholic. And it was therefore in the Northern Netherlands that there was this great sense of freedom. A lot of people, like Descartes himself, like John Locke later on in the century, many others, fled to the Netherlands because they were safe from religious persecution there. Even though Descartes, as we said earlier, was orthopractic, he was still rather anxious about the fact that his publications had a tinge of unorthodoxy about them, and he felt a lot safer in the Netherlands as a result. Now, the Netherlands was also by far the richest part, or had been the richest part, of the Spanish Empire. So when the northern states of the Netherlands broke away from the Spanish Empire at the end of the 16th century and a war followed, it was because the Spanish Habsburgs wanted to get the Netherlands back. They were very active, very successful in trade. It became a very, very rich, flourishing little part of the world. And it was on the back of that wealth that this great ebullition of art and of a sense of freedom and openness followed. So it was a little gem of a place, really. And no surprise at all that a lot of thinkers went there. And it would not have been possible for the very great philosopher, Benedict Spinoza, to have written his works anywhere else in Europe, because even in the Netherlands, with all its freedom of view, he was in some danger.
Yes, it was quite a revelation to me, I must say, this sort of century of republic, really, or quite a lot of it anyway. Look, I'm going to cut through masses of what you write, but this is a very interesting quote of yours. You write that the old mind is trying to pull the new mind back, even trying to extirpate it, yet using its discoveries in a severity of self-contradiction that approaches madness. Would you please develop that thought?
Well, yes, indeed. You see, I think when we look at terrorism today, terrorists are using aeroplanes and missile launchers and Kalashnikovs to assert a viewpoint which really is pre-modern. It's a medieval outlook, control, very, very orthodox control over matters of dogma and thought, behaviour, practice, certainly over the lives and opportunities of women in society. And so it is a terrible contradiction, but it's one symptom of a tragedy unfolding before our eyes within the Islamic world itself, I think. Because if you look at the situation in the Middle East and in Afghanistan and Pakistan, what you see there is a very deeply troubling and unhappy internecine conflict that Islam is having with itself. It has some resemblances to the difficult and tragic circumstances in Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries.
Indeed, it does.
With the Reformation. And so it could be, I mean, it's all very difficult to make these comparisons direct or predict the outcome, but it could be that the Islamic world is having its own 16th and 17th century right now.
Yes, that's what was suggested to us. The fear of this dramatic, you know, seismic shift really does produce responses that we certainly don't plan on. Look, lastly, you've also written in one of your prospect columns that too much information, like you're giving us now, can cloud our judgment, particularly around big decisions. How much does the information overload restrict us then, do you think, from flourishing in this century that you want us clearly to do, making good changes for future generations?
Well, the fact of this tsunami of information, of data, of facts or supposed facts or claims that pour out at us from the internet makes a demand on us, especially those of us who are interested in education, to get people thinking a little bit about how they deal with that information, how they manage it, how they organize it into the sorts of patterns that constitute knowledge. Because, of course, data by itself is not knowledge. And then to take the further step, because there is a really significant step beyond knowledge, and that is understanding. Understanding what you know, understanding how to put it to work, understanding which bits of it are important and which bits aren't, understanding what else we need to find out, what more data we need to organize into patterns of knowledge. So the problem that I'm trying to identify there is that this overwhelming barrage of information that we get, given the fact, by the way, that we've lost the filters and the gatekeepers and the people who interpret that for us. Not entirely. I mean, there's your very good self indeed doing some of this on the radio at this very, very moment. But we do need people to become good gatekeepers and filterers themselves.
They've got to
become very good at evaluating all this information.
But surely it means standing back and giving yourself some space to do that evaluation, does it not?
It does indeed. Yes, you do need to give yourself that little bit of time. But you know, the main challenge that has to be accepted really is to think these things through and to verify. In other words, you read something on the internet and you think, oh, heavens alive. But before you accept it or before you're altered in your behaviour by it, you ought to check it out.
A.C. Grayling, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. Thank you very much indeed. I hope you enjoy your stay in Australia.
Oh, I love being here. And thank you so much for having me on your program.
A.C. Grayling, Professor of Philosophy, Master of the New College of the Humanities in London, a bold venture by him, regular contributor to many British newspapers and magazines, and his book, The Age of Genius, The 17th Century and the Birth of the Modern Mind, is published by Bloomsbury.